Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Hello, hello. Welcome back once again. Here we are, an adventure in history.
This really, if ever we have lived up to the title.
We're going underground with our history.
Well, and all over.
All over the place.
Yes.
That's true. We are. Because we have a very special guest.
I'm going to predict right now this could be a two-parter if we really wanted, or a three-parter. But, but she's busy, so... We're probably not.
We have Chelsea Rose with us. She's the director of the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and a historical archaeologist.
Yeah, welcome. Hi. Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
And neither one of us wants to pronounce the word, so we're going to dive right into that and get that out of the way.
Yes, I am also part of the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project, so, and we use that word all the time and forget that a lot of people are like, what is that? Yeah. But it's not anything super complicated or scary. A diaspora is basically just a group of people that are away from their homeland but still have a lot of shared traits and community, and you know, the diaspora of Chinese folks in Oregon is truly a global diaspora. So we think that that also helps frame, you know, more accurately the way that the history of Chinese immigration to the state, really how it was experienced by folks then and how we should be thinking about it today.
Right. Fascinating. Okay.
I know. Okay. So we're going to whip through the history.
Yes, we are.
It's so fast. You're not even going to hear what I'm saying. So these are the history highlights, things that happened on tomorrow, August 11th. And I should give a little heads up that we're recording this far earlier than we normally do. So even though we pretend this is live on tape and we're like in the studio.
It's our big secret.
She's in town doing a really cool project.
And we couldn't let her leave.
But exactly. So August 11th, 1806, Meriwether Lewis is shot in the leg while hunting elk along the Missouri River. He is shot through the thigh, probably by one of his own men.
Well, probably.
Probably.
Who else would it be?
Oh, and I forgot. I wanted to do a guessing game here. The world's first roller rink opens in Newport, Rhode Island. What's the year?
First roller rink.
The world's first, and it's in Newport, Rhode Island, of all places.
I say 1901.
1901, good guess.
1922.
1866.
Oh.
Isn't that crazy?
Way off.
Yes, that's a lot.
We were this close to fighting the Civil War on roller skates. Whoever guessed?
How funny.
Those original roller skates probably look like torture devices.
Right?
Like, oh, they probably did. Yeah. Like little spikes to put on your feet or something. All right. 1896, Harvey Hubble patents the electric light bulb socket with a pull chain.
Oh, okay.
I like the pull chain. How do you feel about the pull chain?
Oh, of course.
I'm down. Okay. I still have some.
Yeah. All right. 1914, John Bray patents animation. And I thought, how could somebody patent animation?
Right.
And of course, tying into the film museum, we are going to have to do a deep dive on this because I went down a rabbit hole and then stopped. So
okay,
I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, deep tease, everyone.
Deep tease. 1934, federal prisoners land on Alcatraz. And I've forgotten, have you visited Alcatraz?
I have Alana? Not. Okay. No.
Have you, Chelsea?
I have, and I escaped.
Yeah.
You did escape.
I escaped Alcatraz.
I actually liked, I've been there twice, first time before they had the headphones. And then the second time where they gave you headphones for the entire tour.
Yeah.
And I was skeptical of the headphones, but I kind of loved them.
Yeah. It was nice that you had a little more context, but it was still self-guided.
Right.
Okay. Excellent. And I did lay down in the yard pretending I'd just been shivved by somebody.
Of course you did.
I have a photo of me.
And I was going to say, and you took the photo.
Of course I did. I'll be posting it later. No, I won't. 1973, even though it's not an Oregon film, American Graffiti opens.
Yeah.
Like that film. 2014, Oscar-winning actor Robin Williams dies at 63. How sad.
Yep.
It's so sad for everything. But our history highlight, it's a tie. I forgot today's a tie. Two things I think had the most impact. 1988, Al-Qaeda forms at a meeting between Osama bin Laden, a guy named Ayman Zawahiri, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, and Dr. Fadi in Pakistan. Kind of had an impact on history.
Right.
But the other thing that happened in 1973 on this date, hip-hop is born.
I love that.
At a back-to-school party for teenagers in the recreation room of an apartment building in the West Bronx, hip hop is born. And it was by a guy, a DJ, a guy named Clive Campbell, better known to history as DJ Kool Herc. He uses two turntables playing the same record at the same time to create the merry-go-round technique. Hip hop, huge impact.
Yeah.
I love that they know the exact date. That's, I know. Awesome.
Isn't that crazy? Like, he never did it before at another party, like down the street in a garage or something.
I'm like, who is this and who is his agent that says he's the creator? Yeah. I mean,
until somebody disproves it, he's got the title. He's got
the title. Yeah. Okay. All right.
So do either one of you have an opinion of whether hip hop or Al Qaeda should be the bigger impact on history, or is my indecision okay?
Your indecision is okay with me.
I vote hip hop.
Okay, there you go.
I was leaning towards hip hop, and then I saw the Al Qaeda.
I just feel like that can't be the day. I mean, right? I mean,
Alana suddenly jumps into a research project on hip hop and comes out with a book and a documentary at some point.
Yes. Well, I know just the person to talk to. She's sitting right here. Chelsea Rose is here. And I'm also going to read a little bit more of her bio because it is pretty interesting. So she's been featured in books and magazines promoting STEM education and currently serves on the boards of the Oregon Historical Quarterly and the Southern Oregon Historical Society. She is the principal investigator with the award-winning Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project, and was a guest co-editor of the Oregon Historical Quarterly issue dedicated to that topic, and co-edited Chinese Diaspora Archaeology in North America, available from the University Press of Florida.
Florida, I knew you'd like that.
Yes.
So we had you speak about 2 years ago, we think, at our Thursday night talks, and you knocked the socks off of everybody. You were amazing. But give a little background before we get to this project and what you're doing in town right now. How did you get into this? What was your interest in this? And give us some of the adventures you've been on.
Yeah. So I have always been, I grew up in the West and I've always been interested in the history of the Wild West. And so I first thought that I would study that, you know, the West as a wild and crazy place. And the more that I started doing that in grad school and then since, I realized, wow, we really don't understand the Wild West at all. And it's really central to modern identity of people who live in the West, especially, you know, the far West, like Oregon, California and stuff. And so I, you know, as part of that and being really interested in that, of course, that takes you to mining and railroads and all these events in history that are really central to the shaping of the places we live today. And Chinese immigrants are really central to that, those stories. And so my career path really was solidified with the Jacksonville, Oregon Chinese Quarter site. And we excavated there when I was a student at the University of Oregon, and then again when I was with Southern Oregon University in 2013, I think. And we found the remains of a house that burned on September 11th, speaking of dates, at 3 a.m. in the morning in 1888. And so that house basically, you know, provided so much information about this community, and it just really got me hooked on that story. So since then, I've started to, you know, meet with other people studying Chinese history in Oregon, and we realized, wow, if we work together and think about this like more scaled out, we can ask bigger questions, we can really get a better view of what this experience was like for Chinese individuals living in Oregon and how Oregon that we know today benefited from their work and their community. And that project just grew and grew and grew more than we ever could have imagined. And here we are almost 10 years later, because we really started the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project 2017. And we've done work on mining sites, railroad sites, Chinese communities, and then we've wanted to shift our focus to other industries that had Chinese Americans and Chinese immigrants that haven't been as, you know, investigated. And one of them that we just came over from John Day, Oregon, is ranching. So Chinese immigrants were cowboys and ranch hands and sheep herders and cooks and foremen on a lot of these ranches, these historic ranches in Grant County, many of that are still in operation today. So we realized, wow, that's a story that hasn't been told. And then, of course, canning and fishing on the coast. And that brings us here, is to explore and investigate, you know, the role and experience of the Chinese immigrant community in those industries.
So how much have you found? Because you found us.
Yeah.
We're a small historical society. We have a fantastic curator that's amazing, also named Chelsea. And we have a good collection, I think, of Chinese related items and stories. Have you found throughout the state just these little historical societies or museums that do have little bits and pieces, and you're helping to tie this whole story together?
Absolutely. And a lot of folks don't realize what they have. So before I did that trip up the coast where I first came and talked here, I emailed, got in touch with every historical society, museum, heritage organization I could find. And I just like cold called and was like, hi, I'm coming through. Here's what we're interested in. And a lot of folks were like, that sounds great, but I don't think we have anything. And then once I went and met with folks, we started to kind of, you know, not everybody has a big box that's labeled Chinese history. But if you go through, you know, canning, of course, on the coast, a lot of the lumber industries, there were Chinese men employed as cooks. And there's really just a lot of stories and people and individuals that have been kind of erased from history, but were there. And it was really interesting. One of the things I thought was so fascinating in Tillamook, a lot of folks that would see Chinese material culture, like ceramics and stuff, all assumed it came from the shipwreck, the beeswax shipwreck. But those Chinese ceramics are way older. And what that did was kind of obscure the 19th and 20th century Chinese American population that lived in that community. And even in the museum, like I had a great visit with their staff, and we were going through, and even when we were talking, they're finding stuff, and on their display was a Chinese-made stoneware jar that would have contained like soy sauce or something. And it had, you know, not been recognized for what it was. Somebody thought it was a weird teapot. And so, you know, visibly just sometimes hidden in plain sight is the remnants of this population. And our project, since we work together across a whole bunch of federal, state, local agencies and organizations, it's really like an Oregon story. It's not just like kind of a niche part of history. We're able to really see this as an Oregon story.
So I love that what you said, though. You said they get erased from history, because Mac and I do talk about this a lot. So right, we talk about history, but we are only talking about the portion that was documented. So tell me why it is so important to get this documented and then to share those stories to get it heard and get it learned.
Well, I will say too that one of the things that as archaeologists, whenever we hear like it wasn't written down, it's lost, right? We're like, oh, wait a minute. People dropped things and threw away things. And that's where we come in, because that is a form of documentation. But, you know, what I think is really interesting when it comes to the Chinese diaspora history, but also other historically marginalized populations that came from other places in the world, or women or children. You know, there's a lot of folks that didn't get the same kind of coverage in the media or in, sure, you know, elsewhere. And so there's a few things about that. Number one, when it comes to Chinese immigrants, a lot of what we know about them is because of the laws that were built to exclude them and to, sure, discriminate against them. And so a lot of times some of the stories are very victim narrative-y, and that really takes away a lot of the humanity from this population, the agency. It obscures all the ways in which they did really important things, had successful businesses, had great collaborations and built communities. And then also, you know, we don't want to make it seem like, you know, Chinese immigrants aren't part of Oregon history. Like I said, there's modern descendants of this population. And in many places, the Chinese immigrant community was there longer than the people that came in, you know, that were Euro-American. And some of those folks became like the founding fathers of these communities, never mind that they weren't even there first, you know. And of course, that's not even including the indigenous, you know, it's like, right, so complicated. But I think that it's really important to see these historical populations and to recognize their contributions, because I think that that's also the antecedent for a lot of the political divide that we're experiencing now, especially in rural areas. Our project really focuses in rural areas, and the erasure of, you know, these participants in these early communities and early industries like Chinese immigrants, the loss of that history presents this false narrative of the history of these places. And I think that's been weaponized these days, not to anybody's benefit.
Right. So the two reactions to that and a question. At one point, I had to give a little talk, and I was a little uncomfortable doing it, about the Chinese in Astoria, because mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on this, but I was giving some of the stats, and there were far more Chinese for quite a while than there were Scandinavians. And I said, why are we known as a Scandinavian town with some Chinese? Why are we not known as a Chinese town with some Scandinavians? Yeah. And I said that kind of in jest, but there's also that truth to it, that there were more. Have you found any kind of pushback about this, that we don't want to change the story of our town when you say rural areas, that, that we don't want suddenly to be a Chinese story? We're all about the whatever, the ranchers or something like that. I mean, have you gotten pushback?
Yeah, we haven't gotten pushback on that. And I think that...
Good.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason is, you know, this project, we've really deliberately, like I said, focused in rural areas. I am a rural scholar that grew up in a rural community too. So, but we put a lot of effort into being good guests in these communities, and we do a lot of public outreach, and we really reach out to folks and try to make it feel like we're not, you know, the ivory tower coming in and telling them their story. So I feel like by the time we get to some of these discoveries, or, you know, and they're not really discoveries, but rediscoveries of these histories, these folks have been there with us from day one, like along the way. And so, you know, the community in Grant County, for example, we've been going there since 2017. And there's a lot of people that are really proud of that history. They've been very lovingly stewarding the Kamwa Chung and Company Museum for all that time. And so, you know, it's not as much as you'd think. And one of the interesting things about Astoria and why we're so excited to be here is you have a descendant community from this population, and that is very rare in rural parts of the state. Most of the, you know, third, fourth generation Chinese Americans are in Portland, Salem, you know, the Willamette Valley. And so it's really exciting to be able to be in Astoria and be meeting with folks who have this family connection here. Coos Bay, North Bend is another part on the coast that also has, you know, descendant population that still lives there and can trace their family back, which is pretty special, I think.
So I want to make sure we have plenty of time. So before we do run out of time, talk about what you are doing on this trip to Astoria.
Well, when I came here before, my goal was to try to find a cannery site to investigate. And what I learned, and what most people that live on the coast probably could have told me, was that they were built over the water. And where they, you know, where some of these buildings weren't built over the water, they maybe are in contaminated landscapes, or maybe there's a road on top. So we kind of came across all those different scenarios and realized, you know, I'm not an underwater archaeologist. I know there are others who come to look at these beautiful shipwrecks you have here, but that's not my expertise. So we instead shifted to look at the community and places in town where we can kind of get to know the community a little bit. And one of the things I'm very excited about is looking at these sites that are associated with the Chinese gardens, because that's definitely an understudied component to this history. You know, there are folks that were very successful farmers, and they fed the community. So if we can find some little aspects of that enterprise or the daily lives of the farmers that did that, I think that'll be a really important contribution to this larger conversation about Chinese heritage in Oregon and beyond.
And where were the clues, not just about location, I want to get to that next, but in terms of, I mean, because I'm still wrapping my mind around ranchers and farmhands. I've never really heard that story before. So how did you like realize, okay, there's a lot in here in Astoria that are having gardens and they're selling their things? I mean, how did you stumble on that? And how did you then find the locations?
Yeah, well, you have some great exhibits here, including the blocked out. That's one. So there's some really cool stuff in there. And I'll tell you, one of the big clues is that there was a law against people having the thing on their shoulders, the baskets to carry vegetables or whatever. And that's here in the exhibit. And those kind of laws don't come out of a vacuum. So anytime I see that, I think, oh, somebody was doing something that was quite successful. Somebody felt a little intimidated or competitive and got it on the books so that they, you know, to try to kind of push back at that. And that gets to what you were saying too, about how did you not know that Astoria had a larger population of Chinese immigrant community than Scandinavian? And that's because of these, you know, almost 100 years worth of anti-Chinese sentiment, which was translated into local, state, and federal laws that all impacted the Chinese American community in different ways, deterred their, you know, them moving to these places, you know, impacted the way that they could build generational wealth or, you know, like to stay in these places. So I think all those things are, you know, that can be an important clue that you can use as a starting point to kind of dig deeper.
And you say here, and I want to tell folks, it's the Heritage Museum.
Oh, yes.
Yep. Sorry. 1618 Exchange Street in Astoria.
I'm not looking for blatant commercials.
I am. I love that. I love that display. I mean, it is a very powerful exhibit, especially for a heavy word exhibit. And I always like to point that out because it was Dr. Chelsea Vaughn who said she was a little uneasy with all the words, but they're powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you doing this week?
Yeah. So we are doing a mix of archaeological excavation, archaeological survey. We have students out here. It's a field school, but we are also taking advantage of all the local resources. So we are doing a lot of tour. Like this morning, we did a tour of Fort Stevens with one of the rangers and doing tours of the, you know, the Columbia River Maritime Museum. So we're just going to be kind of getting to know this community and you know, the types of history that we might be able to uncover. Because, of course, the goal is that we come back again next year.
And we'll have you on the radio again.
Okay.
So for an archaeological dig, and you are doing a little bit of a dig.
Yeah.
Talk about that. I mean, how big? What are we picturing? Because I think when people hear archaeology, they picture Egypt.
Yeah, no pyramids. Well, you know, that we found yet, at least. Well, I'll tell you one thing. We are so excited for the sandy dirt here because that sure makes our lives a lot easier. And that's not what we get down south in where I live near Ashland. But yeah, so we are teaching the students, you know, the science of archaeology. So how do you lay out the square holes, excavation units that we excavate? How do you keep notes and keep track and map everything? Because of course, it's we want to really have good notes so that we can track where things are in the ground, because that's our biggest clue to how things were related spatially and temporally. So over time, what's old? What can we tie to this? We might find some ceramics there, but is it the right time period to be that Chinese American farmer? So, you know, those are the things that we want to, you know, carefully dig down to try to be able to capture those stories, because the artifacts are, you know, unbiased records. You know, I'm biased as the archaeologist interpreting them, but they themselves are clues to what people had access to, the choices they made, the, you know, the lives that they lived, the era they're in. So those are ways that we can kind of infill the historical record where it's lacking.
Is the science so advanced that if you were excavating in a former garden from 110 years ago, that you could tell what was being planted?
Well, I can't personally, but we can take soil samples and then we can send it off for analysis to look at seeds, starches, pollen. So yeah, there are ways that we can get that kind of information. So we would have to find the right kind of deposit, but then it's totally possible. And that would be cool, because what are the farmers growing? Are they catering to the demands of like the Scandinavian population? Or are they growing, you know, stuff that maybe they seeds they brought from China? Are they just growing what grows good here? So I think there's a lot of really good questions that we could ask if we were able to kind of see their seed catalog.
So I think every kid that thinks they want to be an archaeologist pictures either Indiana Jones or they picture I'm at some dig and I instantly find something.
Right.
So give me the reality.
Well, first of all, I always say it's more like Sherlock Holmes than Indiana Jones, because we're not treasure hunting. We're looking at context clues, and that's more like Sherlock Holmes's thing. But I also think that, you know, it's not some archaeologists, I wish I could remember their name right now, but they said it's not what you find, it's what you find out. So this is our first time doing archaeology in Astoria. Of course, there's been lots of other archaeology that's happened here, but on this topic, this is our first time doing this. So it doesn't really matter what we find, because even absence of evidence is information, you know, like it's all information that we're looking for. So, and we're, like I said, we're building community. We're at one site we were at yesterday. It wasn't a good candidate, but we learned about talking to some folks. We got clues to where else in that area might be a better place to look. So I think that it's all information and it's going to just build on, you know, whether we come back and do more archaeology or the next researcher. I think it's going to be, you know, helpful no matter what we find. But hopefully for the students' sake, if nothing else, that they find some artifacts.
So can I ask you the question? How did you get into archaeology?
Yeah, well, I am a product of the 80s and was interested in Indiana Jones and also was really obsessed with Egyptology. You brought that up. So I was like writing poems about Egypt and drawing pictures about it when I was young. And I just got to go to Egypt for the first time last year. So that was a very cool, you know, bucket list moment. But yeah, I've just always been interested. Like I said, I grew up in the West, the Wild West. So just interested in people and, you know, how communities are formed and what were people doing, and, you know, just always just curious about that kind of stuff.
Okay. I love it. And then what's your favorite project that you've been working on aside from coming just to Astoria now?
Oh, yeah. Well, boy, that's hard to pick out. I mean, I've done a lot. I've gotten to work in Scotland. I've gotten to work in China. So it's every project has something different and unique about it. But I have to say, I love Jacksonville. I live near there, and it's somewhere I've excavated almost all over that town. But every time we do a project there, we find something really cool. Just recently, we unexpectedly found, we were working at a site, and it turned out it was a woman was running one of the earliest breweries in the state. So, you know, that really throws a lot of the things we assume about the Wild West and these saloons and how crazy they are, that kind of turns everything upside down when you realize it was a family business. Right. So, yeah.
That's incredible. So talk just a little bit. You said Scotland and some other places. How do you need to be an expert in a culture to be able to do something like that, to know what you're looking at, or how does that?
Well,
because I'm not an expert on anything.
Yeah. I mean, it helps if you've done some study, and in some levels, archaeology, some of the methodology and the principles of it are the same no matter what you're studying. But of course, you want to always, you know, talk to folks that are experts, and especially when you're working with, you know, non-European, non-white kind of cultures, you definitely want to go to those communities and see what they know and incorporate those questions and research insight into your project. So, yeah, whenever we do projects, we always are trying to build them from the ground up where possible so that you are getting that community knowledge. And there's a lot of knowledge holders that don't have university degrees, but that doesn't really you know, limit what they can add or contribute to a project.
So talk a little bit about funding. Where does this get paid for? And has anything been in danger recently?
Yeah. So we have a lot of funds for a variety of projects, not just this one, that come from the federal government or different things like that. So of course, we're a little nervous about that. This particular field season and the one we'll run next year was funded. It was congressionally directed spending that Senator Merkley helped to advocate for our project, which is really exciting because in the past, we've always been limited to doing our project where there was some kind of like need. Like we're like, hey, we have to thin this part of the forest. Can you come do archaeology first kind of thing? And so this is what allowed us to come to Astoria and just be like, let's just look around and see what we can find. Let's go find a ranch in Eastern Oregon and try to, you know, be on the hunt for these Chinese cowboys. So that has been a really amazing opportunity for us to explore these stories that probably would not be told otherwise.
Oh, 100%. They wouldn't be told otherwise. So you have a podcast. How do we find it? How do we listen?
Yeah, my podcast is Underground History. It airs live on Jefferson Public Radio, and you can also find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, I love that. Just like an adventure in history.
Maybe better.
Maybe better, yes. But that's what we have on our show. Yes. Well, thank you so much. And we really do appreciate the work that you're doing and the stories that you're sharing. It is important parts to share those stories. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And we expect to see you back in a year.
Okay, sounds good. Part two. Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Go make some history and dig it up.
That's right.
With an expert.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.